This week's episode is brought to you by Indie Blast Podcast Network, spotlighting the best in independent podcasting. If you are a podcaster looking for a network of other amazing podcasts, look no further than Indie Blast. We offer camaraderie of other podcasters sharing in the hustle of trying to make the best and most professional podcasts we can. By joining Indie Blast, we can help you increase your listenership by offering strength in numbers. It will also increase your chances of monetizing your podcast. As I said, there is strength in numbers, and networks provide that possibility. If you are interested in finding out more about the Indie Blast Podcast Network, go to IndieBlastNetwork.com/contact. That's IndieBlastNetwork.com/contact. Hello and welcome to another edition of Everyone Has a Story. I'm your host, Nate Wade. I am so excited to talk to the guest we have on this week. Shane Claiborne joins me here in the dungeon to chat a little bit about his life and some of the things he's been involved with. Some of you may know who he is. I guess you could probably say he's the most famous person I've interviewed on this show. I am so excited for you guys to hear this conversation. But before we do, I'd like to talk about some of the things that are making me happy this week. It's kind of a new segment I've introduced here on the podcast, just talking a little bit about things that make me happy. And I want to know what makes you happy, too. So if you wouldn't mind shooting me a text on Twitter, you can find me on Twitter at KNate Radio. That's KNATRADIO. KNate Radio, or you can hit me up at knateradio@gmail.com and find me on Facebook at Everybody Has a Story and tell me what is making you happy. Three things. You got to give me three things, all right? And here are my three things for this week. This afternoon, I am recording my podcast called The Simpleton Review. It's my extra on the side podcast, as you were. It's a bi-monthly podcast that reviews music and movie featuring yours truly and my oldest son, Lemuel, as well as my buddy, Charlie Gibson. If you want to find out more about Charlie, you can find out more about his story way back at episode one of Everyone Has a Story. That's right. He was my very first guest to join me here in the dungeon and share just a little bit about his life. Well, anyway, on the podcast, Simpleton Review, we are reviewing the new album, AWOL Nation. It's called Angel Miners and Lightning Riders. So if you like AWOL Nation, why don't you stay tuned and find out. That'll be published next week. It is, like I said, it's a bi-monthly podcast. Angel Miners and Lightning Riders. Find out what we thought about AWOL Nation. And we are also reviewing the movie Jojo Rabbit. If you have not seen it, what a funky show. That's all I'm going to say right now. If you want to know what I think about the movie more, then you need to tune in to the Simpleton Review podcast. I'll let everybody know when that podcast comes out. It'll probably be more at the end of the month. The end of the month of May. Can you believe it? The merry, merry month of May is already upon us. So, number two thing making me happy, the spring weather. We live in Idaho, so we have a day that's winter. We have a day that is summer. And then we have a day this winter and a day this summer, and it just bounces back and forth. But this week, it sounds like the weather is going to be phenomenal. And for us, that means the weather is going to be about 70 degrees, which is, in my mind, just perfect. That's all I got to say about that. Just perfect. I can't wait. So the third thing's making me happy. We have started playing Dungeons & Dragons. Yes, I am 45 years old, and for the first time in my life, I am actually playing Dungeons & Dragons. So if you got any tips or any things that you want to give me on how to play the game well, then why don't you give me a shout-out, too, because I'd really like to know how to do that, because I'm not sure I know how to play the game well. But it's fun. I'm playing it with my wife and my son and another guy, and we get online every Saturday night, and we play Dungeons & Dragons. And I am some sort of human soldier, knight, person. I don't know what I am, but I think I'm pretty successful. I think I'm beating everybody up, you know? I'm not dying, all right? That's a good thing. I'm a big, powerful man, you know, like I am in real life, right? No, okay, just don't even, yeah, that's false. I am not, I'm not strong in real life. That's all I'm trying to say here. So Shane Claiborne, like I said, is on the show today, and I'm just going to read straight from his website, the bio, and just talked a little bit about more about who Shane Claiborne is. He's a prominent speaker, activist, and best-selling author. He worked for Mother Teresa in Calcutta. He founded The Simple Way in Philadelphia, and he also heads up the Red Letter Christians. It's a movement of folks committed to living as if Jesus meant the things he said. What a crazy concept, right? Anyway, Shane is a champion for grace, which has led him to jail advocating for the homeless. And he's also to places like Iraq and Afghanistan to stand against war. And now grace fills his passion to end the death penalty and help stop gun violence. So he has a lot of sermons and books and things that have been pretty influential in my life, on my thoughts, and especially on the death penalty. He has books including Jesus for President, Red Letter Revelation, Common Prayer, Follow Me to Freedom, Jesus, Bombs and Ice Cream, Becoming the Answer to Our Prayers, Executing Grace, and his classic, The Irresistible Revolution. So check out those books. You can find those books anywhere the books are sold. You can find them on Amazon and Barnes and Noble and anywhere like that. He's been featured in a number of films, including Another World is Possible and Ordinary Radicals. And his books have been translated into more than a dozen languages. He speaks over 100 times a year nationally, and his work has appeared in Esquire, Spin, Christianity Today, Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, and he's been on everything from Fox News to CNN and Al Jazeera and NPR. He's given academic lectures at Harvard, Princeton, Liberty University, Duke, and Notre Dame, and he speaks regularly at denominational gatherings, festivals. So, yes, like I said, this guy has done quite a bit, and he is definitely probably the most famous person I have ever interviewed. So I hope you guys enjoy the interview with me and Shane Claiborne right here on Everyone Has a Story, right after these messages.
The Untold Story. Blood on the Wall. The Bloody Knife. Broken Glass. The Missing Body. The Missing Piece Podcast.
Do you love a good story? If you do, check out Stories of Your and Yours. I'm Sean Ennis, and each week on Stories of Your and Yours, I narrate a classic short story, adding music and sound effects to bring those stories new life. The back catalog features stories by the likes of Edgar Allan Poe, Kurt Vonnegut, Rudyard Kipling, Mark Twain, Ray Bradbury, and many more. And in addition to classic short stories, I feature original stories by you, the listener. So if you do love a good story, give Stories of Your, that's Y-O-R-E, and Yours, that's Y-O-U-R-S, a listen today. And visit the show at SYY Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram to submit your own stories, requests for classic short stories, or just to say hi. That's Stories of Your and Yours, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, I grew up down south in Tennessee in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains, okay. and I'm not going to hide it.
That's fair.
I've lived in Philly for 25 years, but yeah. Still got my southern charm.
Yeah,
you know? But
definitely.
Yeah. No, I was raised mostly by my mom. My dad had multiple sclerosis, so he died when I was pretty young. I was just turning 9.
Okay.
So my memories of him were he was in a wheelchair, and so we played a lot of pinball with me on his lap.
Okay.
And he was great, but passed away when I was about 9, so my mom and I are tight. I'm an only child, and, you know, in middle school, had a real deep spiritual encounter, sort of fell in love with Jesus, I guess I'd say, you know, mm-hmm. and I grew up in the church down in the Methodist church. But to be honest with you, man, I got just a little bored. So I joined the Charismatics for a little while and
okay.
got rebaptized, and like, they, you know, they believed in miracles, and like, you know, it still shaped a big part of who I am,
uh-huh.
you know, this idea that God's alive in the world. And, there's plenty of the bones that I ended up spitting out from some of that, but I've also clung to a whole lot of it. You know, my life is really, shaped by my commitment to Jesus and to try to do my best at living out his command to love our neighbor as ourselves,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So that's kind of how I grew up.
Okay. So when you were involved in the charismatic movement, you know, a lot of people have maybe some bad connotations when you're talking about the charismatic movement per se and Pentecostals, whether that be in the, maybe the wide, section of Christianity in general, or just people who aren't even Christians. They look at those pew jumpers and those Bible thumpers, and they think they're kind of a little weird. Were you part of weird stuff, as it were, or was this kind of a mainline charismatic church, or what was it?
Well, you know, I began to see that I mean, a whole lot of the history of the church has mm-hmm. a deep, like, charismatic part of it. Sure. I mean, the early church, you know, where we get the word, you know, the Pentecostal word was when the Holy Spirit came down in fire, you know, and mm-hmm. all kinds of stuff happened. And even in the Methodist church I grew up in, they have fire on the hymnals. Yeah. But I, you know, sometimes joke that I didn't see it many other places, you know.
Yeah.
But like John Wesley that started the Methodist church, he was, you know, a wild man.
Yeah,
and
really
passionate about racial justice and abolition and all that stuff. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, I when I got involved with the charismatic stuff, it wasn't like the televangelists and things like that. I it was people that just believed that the Holy Spirit still is at work in the world today and that miracles are still possible.
Yeah.
And you know, I loved it. Because they were really courageous people. They lived like they believed the stuff they said.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of Christians,
yeah.
it was kind of like T-shirts and bumper stickers and doctrinal statements.
Yeah.
And you're like, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's got to be more than that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, when I got saved when I was about 16 years old in a youth group, and they were, I guess you could say they were maybe more, cessationist, you know, that word for lack of a better word. And I always felt like, man, there's got to be something more. So when I got into college, I got more into you know, the charismatic type of circles as well, and because I wanted that thing. There's the mind, and there's the, you know, the reading the word, but man, there's got to be some experiential parts of it as well, you know. John Wimber called it doing the stuff, and that's what I wanted to do.
Heck
was the stuff, right? So
you dropping a little John Wimber. I wasn't expecting that.
No,
that was nice. Yeah.
I've been around the block a few times. So when you got done with school and whatnot down there in Tennessee, did you stay in Tennessee or did you move out of town, or where'd you go?
Yeah. So the part of the story I left out is, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of Southern hospitality mm-hmm. and, the small town, you know, the mountains. I love, there's so much I love, but there's also there's every place has its funk,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
and we were still a very segregated town. The residue of racism was, and in many ways still is, you know, still there. But like, we had the Confederate flag on our high school yearbook and football uniforms and stuff. So I started to have eyes to see outside of that a little bit. And it's kind of what drove me. You know, I thought, I want to see the world a little bit. I want to meet people who are different from me, that don't share the same religion, to have different stories and, you know, growing up and different, you know, ethnic groups people come from, things like that. So I ended up applying to a little school up here in Philly, Eastern University. And my mom was not, you know, only child going away to college. She was like, if God wants you to go to Philly, then God can pay for it.
That's fair.
I got a scholarship. And so I was like,
yeah.
God paid the bill. Mom,
there you
I
go.
Went to Philly. And but, you know, I really wanted to understand sociology. So I studied at Eastern with a wonderful friend of mine now, Tony Campolo.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of a Baptist, you know, fiery
yeah.
preacher, but he's also a really incredibly sharp sociologist. And there's a great way of saying it, a great line of Karl Barth, one of the great thinkers of the church. He said, we've got to read the Bible in one hand, but we got to hold the newspaper in the other, so that our faith doesn't just become an evacuation plan about escaping the world, but that it actually fuels us to care about the world that we live in and injustice that's happening. And so I really like that. And that's part of why I studied the Bible and I studied sociology. And that, you know, it's kind of really formed who I am right now, you know?
Yeah. So how did that work once you got done with that degree? I mean, you had your sociology degree, correct? You got a degree in sociology. That was the final.
Yeah, I actually got a degree in youth ministry because I did that for a while, and then I got a degree in sociology.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, there was an important interruption. I did finish college, but in the middle of our college time, there was a group of homeless families, moms and kids, who had moved into an abandoned church building in Philly. Mm-hmm. And they were living there because there were like 3,000 families on the waiting list for housing. They were really desperate. And they said, we refuse to be invisible. We're going to band together. And, you know, we're going to figure this out. So they moved into this old cathedral. And I have no idea how much forethought went into that. But when they did it, it just lit the city up because it stirred all of this history of sanctuary. And the response of the Catholic Church was that they were trespassing. And if they weren't out within two days, they could be arrested for trespassing on church property.
Wow. So, yeah.
So we read about it in the newspaper. And, you know, the families were brilliant. They had hung a banner on the front of the cathedral that said, "How can we worship a homeless man on Sunday and ignore one on Monday?" And they held their own press conference and they said, "We mean no disrespect to the church officials that own this building. But listen, we've talked to the real owner of this building, their boss, and the Lord Almighty said we can stay."
Wow.
You know, they stayed for months and a lot of them got houses. But that was the catalyst that we organized a student movement to kind of come alongside them in solidarity and even risk arrest. You know, like it was, we were just like, you know, fired up. And it's out of that that we started the Simple Way, the community that I've been a part of here in that same neighborhood. In fact, I got married in the old cathedral. Mm. We got permission to go back in and, you know, some of the families that used to live there came and it was incredible.
That is amazing. So this community you're talking about then is, I mean, is that, what would you, is that like your church people or what is that exactly? I mean, it's a community. Is it like sort of a commune type of thing or what?
Yeah. So we read, you know, in the New Testament, as it talks about the birth of the church, it says in the book of Acts that no one claimed any of their possessions were their own, but they shared everything they had.
Right.
And it says they met in each other's homes, you know, and the gospel was really lived out of living rooms and dinner tables. You know, it was a very kind of not the mega church, but the micro church.
Yeah.
And that's what they were up to. So we were really inspired by that. And we pulled our money together. We bought a building. It's actually right across the street from where I am now.
Nice.
And now we've created like a little village here where we're still trying to share stuff. You know, we've got community gardens and murals, and we're still in the middle of the coronavirus, you know, we're sharing food with neighbors, trying to do that responsibly. So we're trying to take care of folks. And we live in a neighborhood that's been hit hard economically. So we've got a lot of abandoned houses. We've lost 100,000 jobs. So we're just trying to reimagine our neighborhood, you know, and as Jesus said, you know, let the kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And what we ask a lot of days is, what would it look like if the kingdom of God or the dream of God came, you know, on our block or in our city?
Wow.
So that's what we're after. And we're, you know, we have one of the things that we decided is the last thing that we need is another Sunday morning service. I mean, there's church services everywhere. So we just join them. We believe in the church. So we're not trying to, you know, be the church without the church. We're just forming a community that can figure out how to be the church the other 6 days of the week.
I see. So you guys live together in this area, but everybody can go to, I mean, they go to whatever church they want to go to, regardless.
Yeah, we've always had Catholics and Protestants and the Charismatics.
That's amazing.
And the, you know, Anabaptists. So, yeah.
Wow, that's really awesome. I wish we could get something around that like here. I mean, I live in the state of Idaho, and we are we're very conservative, first of all. If there was ever a rebellion in this country, I'm pretty sure it would be Texas and Idaho and maybe Montana that would just totally rebel against everybody else. Now, I'm not necessarily one of those people, so I'm kind of a weird black sheep type of person in this state. But man, none of our denominations here, at least in the community I live in, really like to do anything together. They're just kind of separate, and it really has always bugged me, and I can't seem to get anybody to want to do anything almost at all together. Maybe they'll have like a night of worship or something once in a while, but that's as much as it ever gets happened around here. And that frustrates
me. Well, you know, I think, you know, community's a little bit of a nebulous thing, you know, I think we're created in the image of God, which means we're made in the image of a God that reflects community, you know, Father, Son, Spirit. And when God makes the first human, God says, you know, it's not good for you to be alone. And, you know, we're kind of created for community. Jesus said, where two or three of you gather, you know, I'm with you. So we've been trying to live that out. But sometimes I think it's like we're exercising muscles that have atrophied a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So we got to start small, you know. But yeah. I think even right now in this crisis, you know, it kind of brings the best and the worst out of people. Mm-hmm. You got folks that just completely are held hostage to fear and isolation. And you got other folks that, you know, it's really surfacing a lot of compassion, a lot of courage. And, yeah. you know, I think that, you know, we're kind of made to love and be loved. And so that's what we're just trying to practice every day, you know, and I guess we get a little better at it as we go along.
Yeah, that's good. In your bio, you said you spent some time in Calcutta. With Mother Teresa. Yeah. When was that, like after you got out of college, or where did that happen?
We were in college, and we're, you know, here we are trying to figure out how do we live an authentic Christian life? How do we, you know, as I mean, you were reading the Gospels and Jesus says, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. I mean, he said some yeah. really radical stuff.
Yeah, he
did. We started going, who does that? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people we can think about in history, but who's doing it now? And Mother Teresa was still alive. So we, I won't tell you the whole story, but we ended up getting a phone number from a nun in New York and called, and Mother Teresa answered the phone. And, so we, you know, we went over and worked with her, and I worked, every morning I worked in the orphanage, and I also worked in the Home for the Dying, which was Mother mm-hmm. Teresa's first home that she started. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely holy work, beautiful work. It really transformed me, you know, and as you know, we formed our community. It's in our DNA, you know. It's kind of Mother Teresa's charism is really sort of a part of who we are. So one of the things that she said is she said so many wonderful things, but one of the things that I've really held on to is she said, what's important isn't how much we do, but how much love we put into doing it. We're not called to do great things. We're called to do small things with great love.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, really been a part of what we're doing. So, you know, what's important to us isn't how many people get food, but how much love they, you know, feel as we do it. And, you know, yeah. I think it's a really good kind of, takeaway for any of us to think about, you know, how can we love one person well at a time? And Mother Teresa did that really beautifully.
Yeah, she sure did. Yeah. I used to work at a Christian bookstore, and there was, you know, a few books. There was actually a big picture book they had of her, you know, and of course they had their famous pictures of her hands and her feet. They were, you know, just because of all of the work that she'd done, but such an incredible woman and fearless, you know, totally fearless.
Yes.
It was just amazing. So when you were, you said,
I don't know if you noticed her feet in that book,
oh, yeah.
you know,
oh, yeah.
I was in prayer with her and I noticed her feet and I wondered if she had caught leprosy. Cause I had actually spent some time in a village of folks who had leprosy and other skin diseases. And I wasn't going to ask her, like, Mother Teresa, what's up with your feet? You know?
Yeah,
and so like one day we're talking with one of the nuns and she said, have you noticed her feet? And I said, yeah. And she said, her feet are deformed because we get just enough shoes donated for everybody to get a pair. And so there's not usually a lot left over. Mother Teresa, you know, she's trying to take this idea of honor the needs of others above your own, love your neighbor as yourself, you know, so she digs through and gets a couple of the worst pair of shoes, and that's what she wears. And, you know, I just, that stuff blew my mind, you know, and I mean, she, you know, she had her own rough edges and, you know, things that she wrestled with, but she's one of those people that, you know, someone once said, all that a saint is somebody that God kind of drops a handkerchief to earth and leaves the scent of heaven on it, you know,
right.
and hopefully all of us can do that a little bit with our lives, but she sure did it in a magnificent way.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a podcast I listen to. His name is Steve Brown. I'm not sure if you know who he is or not.
I know old Steve Brown. I've been on the Steve Brown show.
I'm not sure I've heard you on there, but I know I've heard Tony Campolo many times and he's always bringing you up when he's talking about things. In fact, that's the first time I think I ever heard about you. There's probably been about 10 years ago, but Tony was on there talking to Steve, and of course they always go at it on their show. But Tony or Steve always says, you know, that smells like Jesus. And I just, and Teresa, Mother Teresa was that way. I think she smelled like Jesus, you know. I just, what, you know, just an incredible woman. And so tell me a little bit about your, yes. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and the thing is, there's a lot of Christianity that doesn't smell much like Jesus, you know, and that's the problem. I'll tell you one other thing with Steve. When we had a big fire in our community about 10 years ago, it's a little over 10 years ago, and it burnt down like a whole block here. It burnt down our community center and all kinds of stuff. And Steve Brown, you know him, but some of your listeners may not know.
Yeah.
Like, we don't agree on a number of things, but we like each other, you know?
Yeah.
And he did a huge fundraiser for us, and it meant so much, you know, because just going at the end of the day, if his house burnt down, I hope I would do the same thing for him, you know, and it just meant a lot.
That's good to hear. Steve Brown, he seems like a pretty cool guy, and I, you know, like you said, there's probably a lot of things I don't agree, especially politically, with him on, but his idea and view of grace has been one of the most shaping things in my life, and I've listened to him for probably close to 20 years now on the radio and whatnot. And his whole idea and attitude about grace has probably done more to save my life than almost anything else, as far as that, you know, that understanding of what Jesus has done for us is just incredible.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about your relationship with Tony, and in the process, tell me how this idea for Red Letter Christianity came about.
Yeah, sure. So I had Tony in class as a sociologist, and you know, and he was, you know, a pastor and friend to Bill Clinton through the Monica Lewinsky, you know, scandal.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, and that was all when I was in college. So it was a real chaotic time. But we became really good friends afterwards. And where we really teamed up was a friend of ours, Jim Wallace, was he was being interviewed by a country music DJ, and this guy was like a secular Jewish country music DJ.
Okay.
That's a lot to get in your head.
Yeah.
But he's talking to Jim, and he says, you know what, I've read a lot of the Bible, and there's parts of it that I love, and there's other parts of it that, frankly, I just find a bit confusing and troubling. And he said, but I've always liked the stuff in red. And he's, you know, talking about the Bibles that have the words of Jesus in red. And he said, you guys seem to like the red stuff. You should call yourselves Red Letter Christians.
Mm.
And it sort of stuck, you know, and Tony and I especially were like, man, that's good, you know, because we believe in the whole Bible. But the problem is that sometimes we interpret Jesus in light of the Old Testament or Paul, and, you know, he gets lost in all of it, rather than seeing Jesus as the lens through which we interpret and understand the whole Bible and understand, you know, the world that we live in.
Absolutely.
So and we sure like how Gandhi, you know, he was asked about Christianity. He said, I love Jesus. I just wish the Christians acted more like him.
Yeah.
So that's what we always say. We say Red Letter Christians. We want a church that looks like Jesus again, and that lives as if Jesus meant the stuff he said.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. And I've really enjoyed, you know, reading the article and stuff that you guys publish on there. It's you know, again, it's one of those life transforming things to me. I've kind of went through a paradigm shift, and it really started. I was very, you know, I mixed my politics and my religion very heavily, especially during the 90s and maybe the early 2000s. And my paradigm shift started to happen after, you know, President Obama got elected, because I was one of those people that thought the world was was going to blow up, you know, and the sky was falling when President Obama was elected. And then I started after he got elected, and I started to see what he was doing and, you know, some of the laws he was passing and whatnot. And I'm like, this guy's not so bad. But yet the world was still falling, you know, with all of these. You know, blowhards, I guess you could say, on the radio and stuff like that. And I'm just like, and some of the worst perpetrators of that were Christians. And that's when my paradigm started to shift. And I'm like, I can't do that anymore. This is ridiculous. And so, and because of that, I started to find out about people like you and some others that really kind of led me more towards living the red letters, wanting to be more like Jesus and a lot less like, I don't even know what word I'm trying to look for here. I've kind of lost my train of thought, but you understand what I'm trying to say, I think.
Totally. And, you know, one of the things that Tony says, that Tony Campola says, he says it so wonderfully. He goes, when we mix our faith with a political party, it's kind of like mixing ice cream and cow manure. Mm. It doesn't really mess up the manure, but it sure messes up the ice cream,
it sure does.
But we really insist on being nonpartisan, but that doesn't mean we're not political.
Right.
You know, I think that the gospel is good news to the poor.
Yeah.
And if it's not good news to the poor, it's not good, you know, it's not the gospel of Jesus. And so when we think about immigration, I mean, these are, they're political issues, but they're also spiritual issues.
Absolutely.
I mean, Jesus says, when you welcome the stranger, you welcome me, you know? So that's where, you know, come to think of a lot of these things is not partisan, but sometimes we're not talking about left and right. We're talking about right and wrong. And we're kind of asking, how does Jesus shape my political imagination? And I think that's the tricky thing, is sometimes we lose Jesus. I mean, look at half the Republicans, like, have absolutely abandoned Jesus. And so many of them look like they're more in love with Trump than Jesus. And I'm, you know, it's my love for Jesus that makes me so troubled about many of the things that Trump says and does.
Yeah.
And, you know, so anyway, when I think of, the politics, especially this year, you know, one of the things that you see in the early church is they had this really beautiful, political imagination, where they, every time they were saying Jesus is Lord, they were saying Caesar is not. And it was a declaration of their ultimate allegiance and where they had placed their hope, you know, their ultimate hope, as the old hymn goes, our hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. Everything else is sinking sand, you know? And I think there is a lot of sinking sand, and there's a lot of like misplaced hope. So even when Obama was running, you know, some of the posters had hope on it with Obama's picture. I'm like, we're kind of setting ourselves up for disappointment here. You
sure.
know? But that's what always happens, you know? And so I've come to think of voting as not, we're not looking for a savior.
Yeah.
Like we found the savior, we're looking to do damage control, to harness principalities and powers,
yes, sir.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, so that's, you know, I want to vote for the person that's going to do the least amount of damage to the world. Like, and no one's going to fit all of my ideologies, you know, but that's where we go. Yeah. You know, that's why it's liberating to go, yeah, my hope isn't in the donkey of the Democrats or the, you know, elephant of the Republicans. My ultimate hope is in the Lamb and Jesus. But that doesn't mean I don't care about these issues. Like, I actually think that Jesus, even when he's talking about real stuff in the parables and his teachings. He's talking about unjust judges and widows and orphans and day laborers and what they're paid, you know? So I think that stuff matters.
Yeah, it definitely does. It definitely does. I have maybe just a few more questions to ask you. I know you've done a lot of work as far as the death penalty is concerned. And, I listened to, one of your talks. I can't remember, what university you were talking at, but it was you'd done one of the seminary, deals there, and it was like an hour long deal. Anyway, it was fantastic. Totally loved it. And I just want to know, how did you come up with this idea, and what kind of pushback have you had from maybe the evangelical church as a whole on your stance as far as death penalty is concerned, especially your idea of believing in the womb to the tomb as far as plural life is concerned?
Yeah, so this is interesting for me because I'm not a single issue person.
Sure.
You know, I'm not even really an issue person. I'm trying to figure out what real love looks like. How do we become a champion for life without exceptions? And that's where I became kind of troubled because I saw how narrowly we've defined what it means to be pro-life.
Yeah.
Often to one issue, you know, and I was there. I grew up passionately against abortion, and I argued actually for the death penalty. You know, I can remember debating in high school and being passionate about having all the Bible verses, you know, to back it up. And then I began to realize this bigger umbrella of a consistent life ethic. What does it look like to be, not just pro-birth or anti-abortion, but really pro-life. And the irony is that you can say you're pro-life in America and still be pro-guns, pro-military, pro-death penalty, like anti-environment, like kind of an obstacle to life on everything but abortion. So, and this is why I began to really focus on both the death penalty and my most recent book, Beating Guns, is on gun violence, because I saw on these two issues, Christians have actually been a part of the problem. Christians are the highest gun-owning demographic in America. We Christians own guns at a higher rate than the general population. You're like, man, here we are worshiping the Prince of Peace on Sunday and packing heat on Monday. You know, Jesus who said, like, turn the other cheek and love your enemies. Yeah. And here we are, you know. So anyway, and then on the death penalty, the 85% of executions happened in the Bible Belt. 85%. So the Bible Belt is the death belt. And the fact is that the death penalty would not stand a chance in America if it weren't for Christians. And that began to trouble me, not just as a political issue, but because I think the death penalty surfaces some of the biggest, most important questions of our faith.
Yeah.
Like, is anybody beyond redemption?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I think there's other questions too, how we understand why Jesus died, because you can have one interpretation of Jesus that says, you know, God had a gun pointed at humanity and took it off of us and killed Jesus. And I mean, I still get questions from people. How can God be against the death penalty when God used the death penalty to save the world? You're like, whoa,
yeah.
Right? We really like kind of twisted and misunderstood that, because my understanding of the cross is that Jesus put death on display.
Yeah.
But not to glorify it, to subvert it.
Right.
You know, as Colossians said, he made a spectacle of the powers of death and triumphed over them, you know, with the cross and with his love. So I think Jesus is kind of like water poured on the electric chair to short circuit the whole system of death,
yeah.
You know. But that's why it's so important. And I'm you know, I'm really passionate about this, because when you look at the Bible, it's filled with messed up people. Moses killed a man. David killed Uriah after he raped Bathsheba. Like, Saul of Tarsus was a murderer. If we believe that murderers are beyond redemption, we could rip out half the Bible because it was written by them. You know, like,
absolutely.
This is like you said, this is a story of grace. It's a story of how good God is despite all the crazy things that we do. And like, God's love prevails. And if we believe that, I think it just makes it impossible. I mean, as Pope Francis said, it's just a complete contradiction to everything in the gospel to continue to defend the death penalty.
Yeah.
And I'm excited, because there was a study done of millennial Christians. So this is, you know, folks born after 1980, and like 80% of them are against the death penalty.
Yeah, that's good.
You know, and it's not in spite of their faith. It's because of it. They just can't reconcile, you know, electrocuting someone like Tennessee is doing right now, still using the electric chair in the heart of the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And, you know, a Christian governor that's doing it. And then you're reading Jesus say, blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. So I think we will be the generation to abolish the death penalty. For me, the question is what role Christians will play on that. You know, will we be on the right side of history, or will we continue to be a part of the problem?
Well, I don't want to give up hope. Hopefully we will be on the right side of history. You know, that would be great.
Yeah, I hope so.
So what was the other question I was going to ask? I had one in my mind and it totally – oh, I know. So in a lot of circles, I guess they would consider you a progressive Christian. This is the phrase I hear, you know, batted around. And I guess that means because you believe in social causes and you work for social causes and you fight, you know, against the death penalty and those kind of things. And because of that, you know, obviously, depending on what rabbit hole you go down on the internet, you're going to find, oh, Shane Claiborne's a heretic or whatever. How do you deal with that? I mean, because from what I've seen from you, you seem to have a pretty easy way connecting with people that may not have the same kind of bent as you, as far as maybe some of your beliefs are concerned. So how do you do with that?
Well, first of all, I there are a couple of things. That's a great question. And part of it is, I would say, like, I don't really find many of these labels very helpful.
No, they're not.
Conservative, liberal, progressive, whatever. They're usually a way of identifying, boxing someone in, saying, I'm not one of those, or I am one of those, or whatever. You know, so what I think is incredibly important is that this is not brand new stuff. This is ancient stuff.
Yeah.
The consistent ethic of life that we just talked about, I didn't make that up. Like, the early church for 300 years had a consistent ethic of life. And they did speak passionately about abortion.
Right.
But they also spoke just as passionately against the death penalty, against militarism and war and the violence of war, against the gladiatorial games and every iteration of violence in their culture. They were so consistent. And we've kind of lost that, you know. So I think it's just it's absolutely hilarious to me that we would think this is kind of a new progressivism.
Yeah.
It's actually a really ancient you know, going back to the early church. But I think in, we have to be careful of self-righteousness because it also is nonpartisan. And there are lots of very self-righteous people on the left and on the right. And it's toxic. It's just toxic to, as Jesus said, to stand up and say, thank you that I'm not like those people, whoever those people
are. Right,
you know?
Right.
And sometimes the left and right kind of mirror each other's, you know, self-righteousness and all that. And Jesus talks about someone that just beats her chest and says, you know, have mercy on me, a sinner. And I think we need a posture of humility, and that shouldn't take away from the fire in our bones. I mean, I feel very passionate about many of the things that I'm, you know, having my, that I believe. But we've got to leave room for people to change, you know, and we've got to win people's hearts and minds. And, part of what gives me some patience with that is I look in the mirror and I see how different I am now than 10 years ago and much less 20 years ago, you know? And so, you know, when I was in Texas, this dude came up to me and he goes, man, I got to tell you, I'm a redneck. I'm a, you know, gun toting, pickup truck driving, whiskey drinking redneck. And he said, but I've been reading some of your stuff and it got me reading my Bible. And then he said, I wanted to ask you to pray for me because I'm a recovering redneck. I said, I can do that, man. I'm a little bit of a recovering redneck myself, you know? So I look at you know, I think the church has got to be a place where we, you know, invite people to come as they are, and but then not to leave as they are, you know, to be really to let go of some stuff. But that's all centered on Jesus, you know, and that's why, you know, when Tony says sometimes he goes, when people tell me it, when people say to us that the church is full of hypocrites, Tony's got a great answer. He says, no, it's not. We've always got room for more. So I think that's, you know, we've got to have some grace with each other, you know, without compromising the cost of discipleship.
That's good. That's good. And so do you like going in, you know, and talking to people that maybe don't believe the same way as you or whatnot? I mean, do you have a lot of pushback from people or not? Do you feel like you do?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to engage people around new ideas. And there's people I talk to that are brand new to Jesus. I mean, I talked at a social justice event. They said, we've never had a Christian speaker. In fact, there's some people that are a little nervous that you're going to give an altar call or something. And I'm like, you know, I might. No, I'm just, you know, and then, you know, there's other events that, like, I spoke at Liberty University, Jerry Falwell School. And, and yet after that, that one of the first people that came up to talk to me was a soldier that had fought in Iraq, that was haunted by what he did. And he just said, I really believe that. He asked me to pray with him. And he said, you know, there's a lot that's healing in my own heart. And it's just hard to hold the cross in one hand and a weapon in the other. And so I think I do get pushed back, but what I see even more than that is I see folks that, are continually just saying, I knew that there was more to Christianity than, you know, televangelists that are asking for money and patriotic pastors that are blessing wars and, you know, cover up bishops that are, you know, abusing folks. And so I think that people hear those storylines and sometimes it shapes our, you know, our imagination of what the church is. But, I see a whole lot of beautiful stuff happening out there. And, so I try not to read all the comments in the feed.
That's good.
Facebook, like that.
That's actually one of my problems that I'm trying to get away from is reading, you know, notes under news. I got to stop that. Anyway, let's.
We have a few standards, you know. If you give us a death threat, we will report it.
Gotcha.
You know?
Well, that's probably good.
If you're using racial racist language or cursing at people, like, you'll get blocked. That's, you know, if you disagree with us though, awesome. Like, we want to engage.
No worries, huh? Good deal. Well, let's change course just a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about your love story. Tell me a little bit about your wife and how you met her and how you guys got together.
Yeah, man, she's great. Yeah. She's she's a North Carolina woman and came up to Philly. She went to Temple. And also grew to live in community, do all kinds of cool stuff. And I'll tell you a little bit here.
Okay.
Since this is, you know, everyone has a story.
That's right. Yeah.
So I had taken a temporary vow of celibacy. I was being mentored by a Catholic monk, and I was considering a life of chastity, a life as a committed, celibate life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd taken a 1-year commitment, not the best time to meet the wifer, you know? And so we wrote letters back and forth, that during that whole year. And then, really discerned that, you know, it felt like we were better together. You know, it felt like we would shine brighter for God together. And so we, started dated, you know, for several years, and mm-hmm. then, got married in the old cathedral and been living that. We got this abandoned house here that we fixed up together. And my wife's very, she's very skilled at many things, but, she took a women's carpentry class, and we fixed this house up. She's been teaching in the schools, and she's got all kinds of passions. But the most recent one is that we've both been training to be blacksmiths.
Oh,
so my
really?
Wife's a much, much better blacksmith than I am. And I don't know if you know this, but we've been taking donated guns, Nate, and turning them into garden tools inspired mm-hmm. by the old, prophetic vision of beat your swords into plows.
Right.
And, you know, we don't have many swords, but we got 300 million guns. So we've been taking them off the streets and turn them into garden tools. And, we're both, apprenticing blacksmiths now.
Gotcha.
And, so
you're learning how to turn those guns into tools yourself. You guys are doing them yourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I got an arsenal of guns in my basement. They're
really?
All chopped up though.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
not one that, you know, but we're, yeah. So we're,
that is wild.
And then, Katie got, you know, we got into this, there's a whole movement of school buses turned into tiny houses, the schoolie movement. I don't know if you've seen that because,
no, I have not.
You know, school buses get retired mm-hmm. or they get, you know, like get rid of them. And they're well-maintained and have low miles, kind of like a rental car or something, you know,
yeah.
but they get rid of school buses. So you can turn them into something. And, we really reap the benefit of another couple's work for the most part, but we've, now got this solar powered, school bus turned tiny house that we travel in. It's got all of our blacksmithing
really?
Equipment. So we can just, you know, go along and pick up guns and chop them up and, you know, whatnot. So
you travel across the whole country doing that?
Yeah, we just did a 40-city tour with the Beating Guns book, and it was awesome.
Well,
I
would challenge you to come to Idaho. I'm not sure how many guns you'd get here. We're very proud of our guns in this state, maybe a little too much so. But yeah, hey, come to Idaho sometime and try to do that. Love to see it.
Yeah, man. Well, there's a lot of folks that are rethinking. You know, I mean, we're not just talking about folks that have hunting rifles
yeah.
or, you know, had a lot of folks that come back from the war, veterans
yeah.
and others. I mean, the suicide rate's astronomical, that want to get rid of their weapons, or folks that, you know, there's a lot of tragedies, folks that have had a murder suicide in their family and they want to get rid of the guns, or, I mean, just every, all over this country, we heard those stories, and it was both heart wrenching, but also such holy work to,
yeah.
you know, literally take the hammer together at the anvil and transform something. And it was like more than just symbolic. You know, you really felt people's hearts getting healed. And I had people in the middle of a program say, I'm going to go home. I'm rethinking the handguns we got in the house. I'd like to bring them back. And we,
That's
you
good.
Know, chop them up. And
That's
this
good.
One guy's pounding on this gun and counted to 18. And he said, that's for the 18-year-old whose life I took.
Hmm.
He had killed someone, you know. And
wow.
I mean, just one story after another, folks that had survived mass shootings. So, I think, you know, what we really want to do is, see hearts transformed. It's not just about, taking away guns
oh, yeah,
or,
sure.
you know, yeah. like abolish the Second Amendment or something. You know, people sometimes will say to us, well, it's not a gun problem. It's a heart problem. And I always say, you know, why can't it be both? You know,
yeah.
we need God to heal hearts, but, we need to change some laws, do a better job at, you know, protecting people's lives. And, so that's, we're kind of trying to do both. I think most of the issues, you know, even if you think about, the civil rights movement, you know, like it was both a heart problem and a gun or a heart problem and a race problem, you know, racism problem. So we needed God to heal hearts, you know, like no law can change a racist heart, but, we also needed to make sure people could swim in the same swimming pools, right?
Yeah.
And have the same rights. So,
exactly.
Yeah, and vote and things like that. So, exactly. Yeah, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm about ready to let you go. If you got time, I've got just a couple. I like to end my podcast with some really kind of, I guess you could say, kind of dumb questions just for fun, just to kind of maybe kind of see behind the veil, as it were, a little bit. Are you willing to answer a couple? They're simple, dumb little questions.
Totally, man.
Right on. Okay. So first question is, who's your favorite superhero?
Oh, man, I'm going to be so bad at this.
And it doesn't even have to be like a Marvel superhero. It can just be whatever. I mean, whoever you see as your superhero.
My wife has a cape. Does that count?
There you go. No, that's brownie points right there.
Pretty good. The Wonder Woman thing was pretty good, too, though. Yeah. Like the Black Panther, that's pretty good, too. I mean, my superhero knowledge is really darn limited, you know. But I'll give you one more outside the box answer. My friend Brian Stevenson down in Montgomery. He's the subject of the new film Just Mercy.
Mm,
and
yes.
Honest to goodness, like he's a death penalty lawyer, but he's much more than that. He really is one of my heroes. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Yeah. I've yet to see that movie. I've heard a lot about it, and I've heard a lot about the book, and I have not read or seen the movie yet. And I really need to do that, I think. Next question is, who's your favorite band or musician? Doesn't have to be a band.
Wow. These days.
Yeah, sure. Current. You can either do all-time favorite or current.
I wasn't sure if this is supposed to be rapid fire. Probably is, but I'm terrible at rapid fire.
No. So, I only have a couple of questions. No problem.
This is like sipping sweet tea on the porch. You just can't do that with me, you know? But I totally grew up like 80s glam rock, you know? Bon Jovi was my first concert, you know, and stuff like that. Then got into the punk rock a little bit, you know, so I will have to confess, you know, I was listening to a little Rage Against the Machine and whatnot in the college years, just heard about the reunion show. One of the many, not the most devastating. There's many other, you know, very serious things, but the Rage Against the Machine reunion show will not be happening. I'm reckoning.
Yeah, probably not. You know,
I used to like Crash Dog, but we listened to Tracy Chapman.
Tracy Chapman's
something special. And boy, I love Sweet Honey on the Rock. Do you know Sweet Honey on the Rock?
No.
Oh, boy, they're something else.
I'll have to check them out.
And the last one I'll say is I loved Rich Mullins. He was a friend, and he was a great songwriter.
Yeah.
And just somebody, if there was a red letter Christian, he was definitely one of them.
He certainly was. I had a chance, because I was working at the bookstore, we brought in Rich Mullins, and so I had a chance to meet him, and he got done with his – and it sounds like this is the way he was everywhere, but he gets done with his jog. He comes in to the back of the performance area. He's sweaty. He's got his sweat ring down on his T-shirt. He has no shoes on at this point in time. And he comes and he shakes all of our hands. Hey, how's it going? Nice to meet you. Blah, blah, blah. And we're like, oh, he's got to go back and change. And he walks out on that stage with the exact same clothes he went jogging in.
Of course he did. Hey, you see, I don't branch out on my white shirt much. I learned the white shirt from Rich
Mullins. There you go. There you go. You
don't even have to think about what you're going to wear. You know, it's white shirt day.
Yeah.
You know, mine's a little brown, but, you know, it's just because I wash them all together and whatnot.
It's all good.
But that was I got this thing on my fridge. It says it's these two nuns asking each other, so what are we going to wear today? I think Rich Mullins was like that. Pretty much. Jeans and white shirt. Yeah. I love that dude.
He was amazing. In fact, he's one of the, I'm going to ask you this next question, but as far as your favorite quote, but one of my favorite quotes actually comes from Rich Mullins. He had somebody had asked him, you know, he's talking about like, he hears people say, I want to be used by God. He's like, you know, this person wants to be used by God and that person wants to be used by God. And he's like, look, he says, if you look at the Bible, anybody was used by God. The donkey, Balaam's donkey was used by God. Pontius Pilate was used by God. So you don't have to be anybody special to be used by God. He says, I'd rather be wanted by God than used by God. And I was like, dang. Mm. That's really good. That really changed me. So speaking of that, what is your favorite quote?
Mic drop on that one.
Yeah no doubt.
I really think at the end of the day, I like that they say John the apostle, when he was dying, he said, love one another and do whatever you want. You know, love one another, and do whatever you want. But I think, I also really love, well, I'm going to give you another Rich Mullins one there, because he had some great, lines. But what I'll never forget, when we were in college, he goes, you guys are all into that born again thing, and that's awesome. We need to be born again. You know, Jesus said that to Nicodemus. But if you tell me I got to be born again, I can tell you, you got to sell everything you have and give it to the poor.
Yeah.
Because Jesus said that to a guy too. And then he goes, but I guess that's why God invented highlighters, so we can highlight the parts we like. That's a good one too. I'll stay on theme there with the old Rich Mullins.
That's good. He was a blessing, and it was a sad day when he passed away. That's for sure. But we get to see him someday.
Okay, I'm going to give you one more Rich Mullins.
Go for it. Please do.
He would like this. He would like you to end your show. I'm feeling it. Okay. You know, we're having the charismatic, you know. He said, you know, there's that Old Testament story that God spoke to Balaam through his donkey. And he said, God spoke to Balaam through his ass, and God's been speaking through asses ever since. So when you meet someone and you think that God could never use them, think again. And if God should choose to speak through you, don't think too highly of yourself.
And we'll leave it at that.
Boom.
Thank you, Shane, so much. It's been an honor to speak with you. I truly appreciate you coming on the show today.
Been a blast, man. Let's do it again sometime. Thank you so much.
There you have it. Shane Claiborne right here on Everyone Has a Story. I hope you guys thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. It was a blessing and an honor, and I'm deeply humbled that Shane was willing to come on my podcast. All I did was email him, and he said, sure, why not? And it was a fantastic conversation. It was really like talking to somebody that I'd known all my life. So thank you again, Shane, for joining me in the dungeon and talking just a little bit about your life. If you want to be on Everyone Has a Story, you can reach out to me. You can find me on Twitter. My handle is KNATRADIO. That spells KNATE Radio. You can also reach me at knateradio@gmail.com or find me on Facebook at Everybody Has a Story. This podcast does not exist unless we have people like you that are willing to have a conversation with me. We don't even really have to talk about your whole life story. I'm really trying to change the focus just a little bit about this podcast to really just have a casual conversation. What do you want to talk about? What's your deal? Let's chat a little bit and have a nice conversation. How does that sound? Especially in these days, it's so much better to have a conversation and then get on Facebook and start arguing and fighting and all that kind of stuff that we do these days. You know, that's not a lot of fun. You can reach out to me on Patreon. I'd love to have your support on Patreon. Please don't do so unless you're willing and able to support the show. So please make sure that you're economically stable before you do that kind of stuff. But I definitely would love your support. You can also find merchandise on threadless.com. You'll find all this information in the show notes, as well as any links that Shane has, whether it be to his social media platforms or his books and things like that. So check out the show notes for all of that fabulous, fantastic information. And you know what? This is Nate Wayne. I hope you guys have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Podcast Network.